Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. A surprise interest rate cut and a gloomy forecast this week from the Bank of Canada due to the falling price of oil and its ripple effect on the economy. The Prime Minister vows to keep his promise of balancing the books this spring despite the grim fiscal outlook. To address the economic concerns, we're joined by Finance Minister Joe Oliver. Winnipeg is the most racist city in Canada. That's the provocative claim made on the cover of this week's issue of McLean's magazine. The bold article has garnered a lot of attention, and the mayor of Winnipeg has emotionally admitted there is a serious problem in his city. The author of the cover story, Nancy McDonald, joins us on the show. On January 29th, it will be exactly 1 year since Liberal leader Justin Trudeau kicked all of his senators out of his caucus. It was an unprecedented move, and to speak about how the Senate Liberals have adjusted to the change, we sit down with their leader in the upper chamber, Senator James Cowan. And the spring sitting of Parliament is about to begin. The McLean's panel takes a look at the top topics for MPs, the economy and the budget, and the preparation for this year's election. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
The drop in oil prices is unambiguously negative for the Canadian economy. Canada's income from oil exports will be reduced, and investment and employment in the energy sector are already being cut.
That's Bank of Canada Governor Stephen Poloz, who this week made a cut to the bank's key interest rate in response to that falling oil price and the uncertainty it brings to the economy. The rate is being slashed by a quarter point from 1% to 0.75%. It's the first time we've seen a rate change since September 2010. Poloz says the falling price of oil may have a ripple effect by reducing investments, increasing the unemployment rate, and shrinking consumer spending.
There will be some offsets, but they are both partial and of uncertain timing. First, Canadian consumers will spend less on energy, and they could save some of the windfall rather than spending it. And second, U.S. economic growth will be stronger, which, along with a lower Canadian dollar, should boost Canadian exports. But the speed of the export response is uncertain, given the export capacity losses of the last decade.
Economic growth will also slow, dropping from 2.4% to 2.1%. The bank governor says to get ahead of this downturn, the rate cut was necessary, and more could be on the way.
We're describing it as insurance, because we want to make sure that if there is more downside risk, that we have appropriately positioned for it. But we must remember that the world changes fast, and if it changes again, we have the ability to take out more insurance, or quite on the reverse, to reduce how much insurance we've taken out.
Now, there was an immediate shockwave from this announcement. Stocks trended downwards and the dollar dropped in value. This all comes on the heels of dim projections by private sector economists. A report from the TD Bank projects the federal government will have a $2.3 billion deficit instead of the $1.6 billion surplus that the government had predicted. Meanwhile, the Conference Board of Canada says the drop in oil will cost the feds $4.3 billion in lost revenue. Despite these reports and negative forecasts, Prime Minister Stephen Harper insists his government will keep its promise that the budget will be balanced this spring.
You know, we live in a world of volatility. These things are creating some shocks that will impact us, but they're not going to throw us off our fundamental growth path or underline the very strong fundamentals of the Canadian economy.
The government has already announced it's delaying the release of its budget until April. And to talk more about the economic woes facing our country, I'm joined on the phone by Federal Finance Minister Joe Oliver, who is in Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. Thank you very much for being on the show.
You're most welcome. Very happy to talk to you.
I know you don't want to talk about the specific interest rate decision from the Bank of Canada, but the bank has also given a very dire outlook for the economy. The governor of the bank saying the shock in oil prices should lead to investments being scaled back, a rise in unemployment, and a reduction in consumer spending over the next year at least. In your eyes, how bad is the economy right now?
Well, the economy is in pretty good shape. I mean, what we've had is an externally induced shock, which has implications both positive and negative. The World Economic Forum just downgraded Canada's economic prospects for next year, but only by 0.1%. We we see the implications benefiting some sectors, hurting others, and having, broadly speaking, in the intermediate term, a neutral impact on the real economy.
But the governor has addressed that as well, saying, yes, there will be benefits and negative effects, but the negative effects are the ones that are going to outweigh.
Well, look, he certainly outlined those issues, and we're very much aware of that. I just want to put the whole issue in perspective. We're still looking forward to growth, which will be better than most G7 countries. We still are in a very solid fiscal situation with our debt to GDP half that of the G7, and we're looking forward to a budgetary balance next year. So while these negatives, are real, they have to be put in perspective of the broader performance of the Canadian market.
But even our GDP, the growth that you spoke of, is going to be has been downgraded as well, not just by the Bank of Canada, but by some of the private sector groups that you look to for advice while putting together your budget. I think, as Governor Poloz put it, it's not a stalled economy, but it's a significant slowdown to that growth.
Well, it is a slowdown, but it's not a huge slowdown as a percentage. And as I said, the World Economic Forum marked it down by a tenth of a point. Others have somewhat different views. We will hear from the 15 private sector economists prior to the budget. We will base our estimates on their projections, and as we do, we'll come up with an approach that takes into account in an objective way what people believe will be the growth, and then translate that down to the fiscal framework, that is to say, how it impacts on our bottom line.
So let's talk about those private sector forecasts, because TD Economics has crunched its numbers, and I think they forecasted, if everything sort of stayed the way in terms of spending now, there'd be a $2.6 billion deficit. The Conference Board of Canada saying $4.3 billion will be lost to the federal government just on oil revenues alone. So, they're also talking about how it's economically acceptable to have a small federal deficit this time around. You don't need to hit that surplus right away. Is that something you're looking at all when you're trying to figure out this budget, considering even private sector economists are saying it's okay?
Well, I would say, no, we are not looking at that. But the first point I'd make is, What they're saying is we're in pretty good shape because they think a deficit wouldn't be that harmful. But, we agree we're in pretty good shape, but we feel it's important to have a budgetary surplus. We promised Canadians in the depths of the recession, when we had to stimulate the economy to create jobs and economic activity, that we would get back into balance when we could. And we've taken a lot of measures to get there. But those measures have not included cutting transfers to the provinces. They continued to go up, and they will continue to go up for social programs and for health care and for equalization. We've announced the biggest and longest infrastructure program in the history of Canada, and we've introduced significant tax benefits for families with children, all 4 million of them. We were able to do all that, even though our flexibility is reduced, and have a budgetary balance, and we intend to get there, and we think that's the right thing to do.
But how can you balance the books when we're seeing so many dire warnings about growth slowing? We're seeing companies like Target closing down shop. There are other companies that announced they're closing down, shuttering their shops as well. 17,000 people out of work through Target's announcement alone. That's going to be a big impact on the economy. Why is it so necessary to get us back into surplus now when you could spend more and be in deficit and help, spark the economy a little bit to get it out of this rut?
Look, we're spending a lot on infrastructure, and we're providing a lot to provinces and to individuals and we're stimulating the economy through low taxes. But just to address the point about the avoiding the deficit, we think it's important to avoid transferring more debt to our children and grandchildren. That intergenerational transfer is unfair. We think it would send a negative signal to investors and to the Canadian public. It would reduce confidence in the Canadian economy. We think it's important to have our interest rates come down. I mean, the interest obligations come down so that the money can be used for social programs. It's very important that our country have the fiscal strength to withstand shocks, of which the oil decline is one, and because we're in good fiscal shape, we're able to withstand that and to deal with the longer-term challenges such as an aging population.
Minister, I'm going to try and get an idea of how you're actually going to balance the books, because you haven't really explained that yet about how you're going to do it when we have so much lost revenue. So I'm just going to ask you some rapid-fire questions. I'll keep my questions really short, I hope, for short answers as well, so that we can get through a couple of these. Will we see any stimulus spending to try and boost the economy during this downturn?
Well, that's something that we'll be discussing in a budget, whether or not that's we have the flexibility to do that.
Will we see any impact or increase on taxes?
We will not be increasing taxes, that I can tell you.
Are you going to dip into the contingency funds? You have about $3 billion each year that you have as a contingency fund. Are you going to dip into those to try and balance the books this time around, given everything that's going on?
Well, I can't answer that today, but I will say that the contingency fund is there for unexpected and unavoidable events.
Would this be an unexpected and unavoidable event?
Well, it is unexpected and unavoidable. But whether we need to dip into it is something that will be disclosed in the budget.
Okay, so you're not going to increase taxes. We're hearing that revenue is dropping significantly. You're not really talking about whether you have room for stimulus spending or not, and you're not saying if you can dip into the contingency funds. So what has to give to balance the books? Should we expect to see cuts to departments and cuts to spending overall to try and make sure that you balance the books? Is that what has to give?
Well, look, I'm just not in a position to get into these details now, because the whole point of having the budget no earlier than April is to see some stability in a rather unstable commodity price environment, and then we will be in a much better position to know where we can go. We'll get a forecast from our independent economists. We'll take the average, and we'll make decisions accordingly.
I asked you last year about income splitting and the family benefit measures that you had announced then that would take about $4.6 billion out of your surplus or projected surplus at the time. And I asked if you thought it was responsible fiscal planning to allocate money that you didn't even have yet that could be in flux. You stood by it at the time. Now we're seeing that flux, the oil prices and the shock that we're seeing from this. Do you still think it's fiscally responsible to have spent that money before you even posted a surplus because you weren't even supposed to make the announcement until after the books were balanced?
Well, we think it was the responsible thing to do. I mean, after all, surpluses are not there to look at. They're there to provide benefits to Canadians. We have the flexibility to honor that commitment, and we will. And we'll be able to do that without going into a deficit.
The issue is, you say that surpluses are not there to look at, but we don't even know what the surplus is yet. And you had spent that already.
Well, we have certainly an idea. We've made our preliminary calculations, and we'll be finalizing those. But we're comfortable, that we will have a budgetary balance, and we will be honoring our commitments to Canadian families.
That was Federal Finance Minister Joe Oliver discussing the gloomy forecast for the economy and the impact on his spring budget. Now, before we go to break, I'd like to make a special announcement. Next week, we will mark 1 year of McLean's on the Hill with a special anniversary show.
It's been a wild ride over the last 12 months, and what better way to celebrate than to connect with you, our listener. Our anniversary special will be recorded live before an audience at the University of Ottawa on Friday, January 30th. If you can make it, we'd love to see you there. Not only will you get a chance to speak with the McLean's Ottawa team, but we'll also give you the chance to ask questions of some of the guests and some contributors to the show. Check out mcleans.ca throughout the next week for more details. Coming up on McLean's on the Hill, we speak with the author of the provocative cover story for this week's McLean's magazine, claiming Winnipeg is Canada's most racist city. We sit down with the Senate Liberal leader, James Cowan, to discuss how things have changed since they were all booted from the Grit Caucus, and the McLean's panel weighs in on the upcoming spring sitting of Parliament. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, we talk about hitting the one-year anniversary of Liberal leader Justin Trudeau booting senators from his caucus, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne discusses her call for new national infrastructure funding, and the McLean's panel takes a look at the upcoming spring sitting of Parliament. But first, is Winnipeg Canada's most racist city? Well, that's the claim on the cover story of this week's McLean's magazine. The article sheds light on disturbing racial tensions in Winnipeg, which are aimed mainly at First Nations citizens who suffer daily indignities and appalling violence. License plates in the provincial capital have the motto, "Friendly Manitoba," but this cover story exposes a darker reality to a city that is deeply divided along ethnic lines. The story immediately grabbed headlines nationwide and prompted a news conference from the mayor of Winnipeg, Brian Bowman, who was the city's first Métis mayor. Surrounded by community and Aboriginal leaders, Bowman was clearly emotional, choking up as he addressed the problem.
I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we came together here today on Treaty One land and the traditional homeland of the Métis Nation. Today, we stand together in solidarity to address challenges and to eradicate ignorance and intolerance in our city and across the nation. Ignorance, hatred, intolerance, racism exists everywhere. Winnipeg has a responsibility right now to turn this ship around and change the way we all relate. Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, Canadians alike, from coast to coast to coast. We're here together to face this head on as one community. To do so, we have to shine a light on the problem we do have in Winnipeg and the problem we share with communities across this nation. Because without the light, we can't see what we're fighting. We need to get real.
Bowman choked up once again, saying this is a personal issue.
My wife is Ukrainian heritage. My family's Métis. I want my boys to be as proud of both of those family lines.
Now, the author of this cover story about racism in Winnipeg is Nancy McDonald, an associate editor for McLean's. She's a Winnipeg native who is now living in Vancouver. Nancy has gone back to her hometown to write more on the fallout from her article, but before she jumped on the plane, Nancy spoke on the phone with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
Just before we get into some of the details of the story, I think in journalism there's nothing more delicate, nothing more fraught than writing about racism. Did you go into researching the story with some trepidation? Were you a bit afraid of it?
I mean, I think there was trepidation on two counts. Number one, I'm a Winnipegger, and so I was going to expose something really ugly about my hometown, where I've still got a lot of family and you know, some of my closest friends live. So I had trepidation on that count. And then you're right. I mean, it's so easy to get racism wrong, but I just had to kind of push those thoughts to the back of my mind and focus on telling the story as simply as I could and not worry about those feelings of trepidation, which, you know, I do admit to feeling.
I mean, I'm going to urge anyone listening to this to go and read the story. It's just an engrossing read, but just to sketch a couple of elements of it, Nancy, tell me if this seems right to you. It feels to me like the sort of the sort of tent pins of the story are Tina Fontaine's death and the election of a new mayor in Winnipeg, a Métis guy named Brian Bowman. Is that how it felt to you? Like those were the kind of two emblematic things in the story?
I think you're right, John. I think Tina Fontaine's murder in particular struck a chord in Winnipeg in a way that Indigenous activists there will say nothing ever has before. For whatever reason, the murder of this 15-year-old girl who was, wrapped in plastic and thrown into the Red River really touched a nerve. And it finally feels like in Winnipeg, too much has happened. It was a fall fraught with a ton of horrific events. A high school teacher felt empowered to post on Facebook these hideous racist comments. The mayoral campaign was actually fraught with racial tension.
Tell us a bit about that. Just for people who don't know, why was it so tense, that campaign?
Well, see, you've got Brian Bowman, a Métis candidate, and then you've got a guy called Robert Falcon Ouellette, who's a Cree academic at the University of Manitoba. And then you had another front runner, a guy by the name of Gord Steeves, who's a well-known Winnipeg politician, whose wife had made these really ugly, ugly comments about drunks downtown. And so these elements actually seem to overshadow that campaign. Robert Falcon Ouellette faced a lot of racism. He goes into detail in our piece about some of what he faced on the campaign trail. And it just seemed like again and again throughout that fall campaign that this issue kept coming up.
And yet the outcome has been celebrated, I think, even by Hillary Clinton this week as a sort of a sign of something, right? A Métis guy being mayor of Winnipeg.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of Winnipeggers will tell you they were surprised that Mayor Bowman was Métis. A lot of people weren't aware of that. The mayor himself will say he did try to make a point of that throughout the campaign. But a lot of the Winnipeggers I've spoken to said that came as a complete surprise to them. But what an amazing person to have as mayor right now, given all that Winnipeg is facing. I was so blown away by his reaction to the story yesterday. I thought he could have come out and condemned me and condemned the magazine and said we were wrong. And that would have been really easy for him politically to do, to stand up for Winnipeg as a new mayor and say they're wrong and stand up for the hometown. But instead he did something so much harder, so much more rare, so much more brave. And that was to acknowledge that, yes, there is a problem, and I'm going to do everything I can to try to fix this. He had on stage with him, I think, some of the most well-known Winnipeggers, the head of the Human Rights Museum, the two chancellors of the university, the top Indigenous figures in the city, and he's made a commitment to try to change things, and I just thought that was so remarkable. I'm just so proud of my hometown right now.
I think everybody who likes Winnipeg must have been impressed by the maturity and lack of defensiveness in that response. Nancy, let me ask you something else, just to sketch for people who don't know Winnipeg. The north end of Winnipeg is sort of the center of your story. What is the north end like? For someone who hasn't been there, what should they know about the place?
Well, I mean, for starters, I'd say it's physically divided from the rest of the city. There are massive CP rail yards. So to get to the north end, you drive over a bridge on top of these massive rail yards, and then you're in just something that is so completely different from the rest of Winnipeg. I think the image that a lot of Canadians have of Winnipeg is of its tree-lined streets, of its wonderful, warm, caring people, and then you get there and you realize there's just a completely different reality for people living in that part of the city, entrenched poverty, dropout rates through the roof, massive gang presence, huge amount of crime, of murder, of violent crime. And I think the reality for people living there is just so utterly different. It's like two universes. And I say in my piece, and this is the honest truth, a lot of people who grew up in the South will literally never venture into that part of the city.
There are a couple of elements in the story that I wonder if we couldn't kind of touch on a little bit. One is, maybe it goes without saying, but addiction surfaces again and again as a problem in your story. Mm-hmm. We talk about Tina Fontaine had drug abuse problems by the time she was being murdered. Her father did. It seems it just is a sort of a refrain. It's a thread that runs through all this. Where do you see that fitting in the picture, and I guess in solutions to the problem?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in Winnipeg will tell you the reason they're turning to these things, and it's, you know, it's just to give you an example of what the problem looks like. I mean, in the North End, one of the major addictions is to gasoline, to huffing gas, or inhaling hairspray. You know, I've been to stores in the North End where they've got hairspray literally on display in those stores. Now, that was years ago. That wasn't recently. I haven't seen that. But so that's the problem there. And people will say, look, this is our reality, and I need to escape this. Literally, life is so hard for some people in that city that they just need an escape. And I think you're right. Tackling that is one way to address these problems. I mean, I think there's so many things that the mayor and civic leaders can do in that city. One of the things the mayor has done, and I mentioned it in the piece, was in his swearing in at City Hall, he mentioned that they were gathered on Treaty One lands, and that was the first time that was ever done at City Hall. And he did it again yesterday at the press conference. And just these little things are deeply meaningful for Indigenous people. You know, the airport could show, highlight some Indigenous art. There could be more murals throughout the city. There could be a series of small things that I think people have told me would feel deeply meaningful, because after all, this is the Indigenous heart of the country. There's a higher proportion of Native people living there than anywhere else in Canada, and almost anywhere else on the continent. Anchorage, Alaska, by proportion, that is a slightly higher proportion of Indigenous people. But, you know, this is, if anywhere in Canada we're going to be celebrating this heritage, it's got to be Winnipeg, and it's just such an important issue.
Nancy, there's in the United States, they've had a vigorous and sometimes angry debate over how to talk about what's usually termed black-on-black crime. I have a feeling we might be on the cusp of that kind of discussion in Canada. In the U.S., people who talk about the amount of, you know, violence wrought by black people on black people is an excuse for pushing the problem away, you know, for saying, oh, that's a problem for them. It's not a problem for white Americans. There's obviously the same danger in talking about Aboriginal crime and Aboriginal violence that is, you know, within the community. How do you see that being talked about, and how do you think it should be discussed?
I think that's incredibly problematic, and I think that's one of the things you would see in Winnipeg is, again and again, there would be a young murder victim, male or female, whether it was gang-related or not, and people in the wider community could discount that as an Aboriginal problem, and it wasn't something you had to address. I mean, you'd read about it in the paper, and maybe you'd think it was awful, but this isn't my problem. No. And so I think what some in Winnipeg have told me is, they feel the very future of the city depends on how this issue is addressed. The growth trends and population trends for that community are, as you know, incredibly high. So there are going to be more and more Indigenous Winnipeggers. And so the future of the city depends on on reconciliation and moving forward on this issue and closing these horrific gaps that exist between in the Indigenous community and the wider city.
Nancy, I know you live in Vancouver now, but I understand you're on your way back to Winnipeg today. Can you give us any kind of a sense of what you hope to do in following up on the story?
Well, first and foremost, we're going to meet with the mayor. I had a remarkable correspondence with his chief of staff yesterday. It sounds like it was an emotional, hard day. Tears were shed. They felt walls were coming down yesterday, that new bridges were being erected. I think it was just an amazing moment, and I think this is an amazing moment for Mayor Bowman, where he can take a lead on this issue, and he can take a lead nationally. He can become a respected national voice in the fight against racism, and I think he has the chops to do it. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the mayor. I wasn't sure, frankly, what his response would be to the article and whether he'd have any interest in meeting with me, because I've thrust a pretty ugly issue on his plate at a time when there's a lot else going on at City Hall. So I'm really excited to meet with him. I'm going to be going to a rally in the North End that's held every week. It's an anti-violence rally run by an amazing young man called Michael Champagne. And I'm just going to try to gauge reaction to this piece. I think McLean's is committed to trying to hold the mayor's feet to the fire, if you will, on this issue, and try to follow the change that the mayor has has said they're going to try to make. So I don't think this will be my only trip to the city this year. I hope to go back a couple times and see and check in and see what kind of progress is being made.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with McLean's Associate Editor Nancy McDonald about her provocative cover story arguing Winnipeg has become Canada's most racist city. To read the article, go to McLean's.ca or pick up the latest issue of McLean's magazine. It was on January 29th last year that Justin Trudeau stunned Ottawa by kicking all 32 Liberal senators out of his parliamentary caucus. The Liberal leader cast the surprise move as his remedy to Senate partisanship and contrasted it with what he portrayed as unrealistic reform proposals from the Conservatives and the NDP. To catch up with how the Liberal senators have reorganized themselves in the past year, John Geddes talked with Senator James Cowan, the Liberal leader in the upper chamber.
So why don't we talk then about some of the specific things you've tried out?
There are perhaps three things that I talk about. First one is that because we were no longer members of a national caucus, it was not necessary that we all come to the same conclusion, that we all vote the same way. Hmm. So we said at the beginning, there are no more whip votes.
So nobody's discipline is relaxed here.
Yeah, nobody's going to tell you how to vote. You have to make up your own mind. Second thing we've done is to say, traditionally, caucus meetings are held behind closed doors. What discussion takes place in caucus stays in caucus. And generally, you have to all come out at the end of the day saying whatever your differences were inside, we support a certain position. We don't have to do that anymore. So I said, why don't we open up some of our caucus meetings to the public to bring in experts, which is something that we never did before. We always had to make up our, you know, come to a position on our own without the advantage of having talked to people who actually were experts. The other initiative we had was to say, we have a question period. It's only half an hour in the Senate. We can only ask questions of the leader of the government in the Senate. But one of the criticisms I certainly hear when I talk to people about why aren't they involved in politics like I was, the answer, and you'd hear it, you know, well, it doesn't make any difference. Why would I get involved? You know, politicians don't listen to us. So we say, well, all right, why don't we invite Canadians to send us questions?
Right.
And we'll ask those questions. So this is a question that John Geddes sent in.
I read that the first question you guys had was from a 14-year-old, or at least a grade 9 kid, who I was asking about copyright law.
Yeah.
Which struck me as surprising. I didn't know that adolescents were that engaged in intellectual property issues. But
absolutely, you never know. You never know. And so it's been astounding to see the kinds of questions that people ask.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Senate Liberal Leader James Cowan about the one-year anniversary of all senators getting booted from the Liberal caucus. Sticking with the grits, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne was in Ottawa again this week to call for a more active role for the federal government in tackling Canada's big challenges. She's been meeting a chilly reception. Stephen Harper's government criticizes Wynne as a big spender. But McLean's political editor Paul Wells sat down with the premier to discuss her call for a new infrastructure transfer program.
You know, we're not saying you have to come up with this amount of cash every year. What we're saying is the way infrastructure gets built is over time, and you leverage your capacity to find that capital, and they've got more room than we do at the provincial level right now. And so, you know, I'm not an accountant or a financier, but I know that the way we are building infrastructure, we could work with them to figure out how to do it in the best way possible. There were also a private sector folks at the speech today, and you know, we've been working very closely with the private sector to get this infrastructure built. So those are the kinds of discussions that we would have if we had this partnership.
That's McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne. Stay tuned to McLean's.ca. Next week, Paul will be writing an article about his chat with the premier. Coming up on the show, the McLean's panel looks at the upcoming spring sitting, the budget, and election preparations in the months ahead. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. And this week I'm joined by McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me, guys.
Great.
All right, so we're taking a look ahead at the spring sitting of Parliament. It's definitely going to be exciting. We have all the preparations ahead of the election, but the main piece of the spring sitting will be the budget. Now, we do have this drop in the price of oil that's throwing everything off. Paul, we'll start with you. What does this economic downturn mean for the budget? And then in turn, what does it mean for the government's election preparations?
It means a lot of uncertainty. Alberta accounted for 35% of all jobs created in Canada last year, with only 11% of the population, which means the Alberta has been driving the Canadian economic recovery. And that's going to be a lot harder in a world where oil has lost more than half of its value. This is why the feds have put off the budget from, they weren't saying when, till later than usual. There has been open speculation about further cuts to spending. I take Jason Kenney at his word because he was immediately corrected and silenced by the Prime Minister's office, so he must have been onto something when he said that likely what the feds are going to do is going to be to profile some spending out longer than before. So instead of a program unrolling over 3 years, it'll unroll over 5 years. The net effect will be that they're going to reduce spending in the short term rather than increasing taxes or canceling tax cuts. This government kind of likes soft revenues because the economy makes the government's case for a less activist government.
Does this give them less wiggle room, John, for election promises and having a budget full of goodies to head into the 2015 vote?
Well, I think following on what Paul said, it eliminates the possibility for a lot of new goodies. I think we saw the main goodies in the fall, you know, in terms of the middle class tax cut package that the Prime Minister announced and the infrastructure spending he announced. I think those will remain the big items in the window. There's obviously not a lot of room to maneuver in this coming budget. I think that's very obvious. So the question becomes to what degree that's a liability for the government and to what degree they could turn to their advantage. It's almost become conventional wisdom now, which is, when you think it was remarkable, that there are lots of people saying could be to the government's advantage. We had David Coletto, the pollster, pointing out a couple of weeks ago here that, you know, there's a sort of a knife's edge here, right? On one side of it, the economy is doing really rotten. The government gets blamed. But there's just some sort of mild anxiety about the economy. It's possible an incumbent government benefits from the sense that people have that, well, it's a time to be cautious, let's go with the devil we know sort of thinking. So I think the political calculation flowing from the budget now becomes that. Is it going to be possible for the government to actually make this a moment for opportunity, for making the case for a sort of steady hand on the tiller kind of argument?
Okay, so let's now take a more general look at the months ahead for the spring sitting. Paul, what can we expect out of the government aside from the budget and economic measures in terms of policy and political strategy over the spring?
Well, there is some talk about increased security measures after the shooting on Parliament Hill on October 22nd and the horrible attacks in France. And then beyond the specific measures, of course, there becomes a whole discourse. Is Canada safer in the hands of this government? Does it need to be protected further still? Or does that go too far towards harming individual liberties? And beyond that, there's the broader, well, while we're talking about security, there's the question about ISIS. In April, early April, the six-month mandate for Canadian forces to participate in the assault on ISIS in Iraq, that will come up for renewal. And it turns out the government has been a little more active on the ground than they said they would be. And so that's going to give the opposition parties room to make the case that you can't trust this government with this mission.
And we'll just switch gears to the NDP now. John, the NDP sort of stuck waging war on both sides because as official opposition they have to target the government, but also you have the Liberals who are consistently polling ahead of them. What do they have to do moving forward?
Well, Paul has a great column in this week's Maclean's explaining some of the background maneuvering in Thomas Mulcair's office, but in terms of what they have to do in front of the cameras, we'll start to see a good indication of that this coming week when Thomas Mulcair gives a speech to the Economic Club of Canada here in Ottawa on Tuesday, obviously geared for him to position himself for the return of Parliament on files for which the Prime Minister has fairly clear positions. Justin Trudeau, not so clear, but at least rhetorically, we see his line is the PM has no plan B. Now we'll see where Thomas Mulcair comes into this. I suspect he's going to want to keep a little bit of pressure on Trudeau by putting some more real measures in the window, and announceables, as they say, you know, things that are not just generalizations, but actual policy ideas.
So, Paul, what's going on behind the scenes then?
The NDP finally had to admit to itself at the end of the year that all the things that Tom Mulcair is best at, and as a matter of fact, remarkably good at, parliamentary debate, pinning the government's ears back in question period, scrumming until reporters collapse from exhaustion. Canadians don't care about any of that. What they care about is a clear idea of what a leader stands for and what he would do to make their lives better. The sort of stuff that Jack Layton used to be very good at. And lo and behold, Brad Levine, who helped Jack Layton learn to be good at that stuff, is now back at Mulcair's side. And we're already seeing a sort of a tighter, crisper messaging from Mulcair, who used to like to talk a lot more. And he's starting to pick his opportunities to get his message across. Not across the floor of the House of Commons, because people aren't watching, but on morning TV shows, marquee business lunches, things like that.
So let's look at the Liberals now. We haven't seen tons of policy out of them. We know that part of their strategy is to hold off until the writ is dropped. Is that the right move to make in terms of policy moving forward? What should we expect out of the Liberals?
There are classic cases of political parties bringing out their platform very early in order to sort of build credibility. Mike Harris in Ontario in 1995. And there are classic cases of parties holding their ammunition back, most spectacularly Stephen Harper when he was leader of the opposition. Until the second day of the campaign in 2005-2006, Harper was seen by Canadians to be nothing but an attack dog. And then he came out with all these very sort of positive, easy to grasp, incremental ideas for moving government in a different direction, and Canadians were delighted. In the end, it's not when you bring your platform out that matters most, it's what's in the platform. And does it seem to be particularly interesting to the leader who's trying to sell it? Michael Ignatieff was only the latest leader who didn't seem that interested in his own platform in 2011. We saw what happened to it. If the Liberals know what they're doing, they're going to try and find stuff that speaks to the values not only of Canadian voters, but also of Justin Trudeau, if he's got any. And because he's got to be the guy who's going to talk about it every day of a campaign.
All right. Definitely going to be an exciting few months ahead of us. Thank you very much, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and Maclean's Political Editor Paul Wells. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Before we go, I wanted to mention one more time that next week we will mark 1 year of Maclean's on the Hill with a special anniversary show. We will celebrate with a show recorded live before an audience at the University of Ottawa on Friday, January 30th. If you can make it, we'd love to have you join us. Not only will you get the chance to meet the Maclean's Ottawa team, but we'll also give you the chance to ask questions of some of the guests and contributors to the show. Head to Maclean's.ca throughout the next week for more details. For more of your politics and your power, join us next week on The Hill.